episode 465 of This Is Whole Life. Have you heard the latest? Bless your heart. Sorry, I had to start out. Cecilia, I know you listen, and Cecilia and Tribe, and I mean, home run.
Fantastic.
Yeah, home so good.
Home run.
Yeah.
So I missed all of song service. I walked in, and I was like, oh, good, I'm going to make it for, and I didn't realize who it was at first because your accent was so convincing, and your hair was covered, and I'm like, so I, and no glasses.
And no glasses.
And I was like, who? Oh, it's Celia. So yeah,
actually, Celia Tim texted Maxson. Me and he said, wow, that actress is fantastic. Who is it? And I said, it's Cecilia.
That's how good you are, Cecilia. Nobody even knew because of that. And I think it's worth saying phenomenal job. And I think we should say Craig. Who is our director
yes,
for that?
Thank you,
did
Craig.
A great job. I think he encouraged the Southern accent, which was a
that was just
completely made it.
Yep.
And then we also need to say thank you to Tammy Cinquemani, who wrote the script.
Mm-hmm. Nice job, Tammy.
Yeah.
Hey, Tammy, check your email about the 15th. Thanks.
Wow.
For those of you who, you know, this might be your first time, This Is Whole Life comes from the Whole Life Church in Orlando, Florida. Every week we get together. Ken Wetmore is our lead pastor. Melanie Bachman. What do you do here?
I don't know.
She's our worship pastor. Lucas, who's our assistant communication director, and me, Randy McGray, we hang out every Tuesday morning. Not as early as we used to. But we get together every Tuesday morning and we go over the message. We answer your voicemails, your text messages, your questions that came in during a said previous service. And so if you want to check out how good Cecilia was, you're going to have to go wholelife.church/media and you can catch, or in the front page right there, there's the latest sermon. But if you're listening later, you'll have to go back and check out Ruth. What was the name of this week? It was
Faithful Strength.
Faithful
and Strength, yeah.
Yeah, because it was Faithful Bitterness last week. So check out, it's week two of Ruth, and go check that out. So next week, I'm just going to give you, because this week we were the name, well, that's what Ken named it. It really was A Journey to Second Kings with a Brief Stop by Leviticus on the Way was the name of the sermon. And so next week we'll have to, I know what the title is, so I'll share that with you before we leave for today, and then we'll be ready for kind of hanging out for next week. So we started in 2 Kings, which was awesome. I often say I don't know where Ken's going. And this week I was really not sure where Ken was going. I was like, wait a minute. This story starts in 1 or 2 Kings. I wasn't sure.
2 Kings, yeah.
And because if you grew up Adventist and you had the My Little Friends, of course, Joash, the boy king, of course, you've read that story, you know, however many times. And then after him, Josiah. Mm-hmm. We're talking about pillars. In circumference, radius, diameter.
We learned some important mathematical things that we'd forgotten since third grade. I will just say I practiced it with you, Melanie, and you didn't say anything to me. So
she was like, let's check this Easter egg out for everybody when they get to the message. Oh, my gosh.
Thank you, Brent, for making sure I knew the...
You know what, Brent? I'm with you. And I can't stand to see people struggle with math. And that's me. I'm the one that struggles.
Or
and that's
geometry, what, whatever.
But no. You can put them all in there. And I struggle as much or more than anyone. So I'm like, when you come up to me, you go, hey, bud, your math, it's wrong. And I'm like, really? Oh, cool. Correct me and tell me what I should have done. Because I will go on like that is gospel for the rest of my life because I don't know any better.
Yeah, exactly. Most theologians' math skills stop at adding up prophetic days.
And historically, they haven't been very accurate on that either.
I was
just saying.
41. Oh, shucks.
Does that year zero count or does it not count? I don't know. I mean,
do I carry the one? Do I not?
So I know man knows the day nor the hour, and we can't add up enough to figure this out.
Theologians are bad at math. Yeah. That's why we're still here.
Yeah, that's it.
If you guys could get your stuff together, that'd be awesome.
It would be. Sadly, we can't be good at everything, Randy.
No, that's true. I mean, Ken does the best that he can, and he's pretty close. It's just the math.
I like that. Ken does the best that he can. I think that ought to be like my slogan.
I think it should be all of our slogans. I mean, there's got to be an exception. acting for, what don't you do well, Melanie?
Lots of things. Yeah. I do lots of things moderately, she's functionally.
She's being humble.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Lucas, what don't you do well?
Oh, I can't even count.
Okay. Well, so
the
three men at the table can't do math.
I can't do it.
and Melanie apparently has some things that she can't. Yeah,
there's a reason I wasn't a math major.
Not you too.
Me too.
Really? Not math?
Not math.
I mean, but
you know, I enjoyed statistics. That was my favorite mathematics-related.
But you don't have to do a lot of math and statistics, right? That's more...
There's a fair amount of that.
Is there a fair amount of math? I mean, I didn't take it, so I can't, like... I just assumed it was... I assume a lot of things, though. We find that out all the time here. So, like, little drummer boys and all kinds of things that we shouldn't assume and we do, and then people take them away and we're bitter. Okay, moving on. Do you want to go through the Joash and Josiah and just set it up for people here?
Do you want me to?
Yeah, real quick.
Okay. So Josiah, let's see if I can remember everything correctly here, 7 years old. And basically, when his dad passes away, he is just a baby. And his grandmother sets about to take over the kingdom by eliminating all of basically her grandchildren. And if I'm getting that right, I do believe I am. And then
Joash, right?
Joash gets hidden away in the temple by a priest there who's his relative. And then when he turns 7 years old, the priest calls together other priests and warriors and makes Joash king.
And time out. Why seven? I mean, if they knew that he couldn't, do we know?
I couldn't tell you the answer to that.
I just thought it was interesting, like seven's a number, but like why?
I don't know. Maybe he got his math figured out by seven. I don't know.
We'll help you with the rest.
He reached a certain level of maturity.
I don't know. Do you know the answer to that, Melanie?
I do not know.
I have no idea.
Okay.
But anyway, for whatever reason, at age seven, he felt like that was the time because who doesn't want to have a seven-year-old be in charge of the country?
Great idea. So
sort of the case, Joash is made king, and they put him by this pillar in the temple. And this is the same temple that Solomon had built. And the important text that I'm using there in 2 Kings says the king stood by the column as was the custom. And so it was customary, apparently, for kings when they came to the temple to stand by these two pillars at the very entry of the temple. And so when we move on in 2 Kings a little further, there's King Josiah, who starts to create some spiritual reforms in his kingdom. He calls everybody together. He stands by these pillars and makes a covenant to follow God's law with his people. And the idea is that these two columns aren't just kind of random. They're the main columns that hold up the entry of the temple. They're where people are able to enter, and it's the king of Israel, the king of Judah's custom to stand by these columns. And they're not small. They're rather large. They're made of bronze.
Can you imagine casting bronze that big?
I can't. No.
What did you say, like 6 feet?
I want to say that it's
diameter?
Like 27, 28 feet tall and then about 6 feet across. So
that's
in diameter,
a lot of copper.
That's a lot of bronze for sure.
Or bronze. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And so, you would, if you're standing there with something that's 6 feet across and that it's 27 feet tall, you're going to feel kind of small by those columns. You're going to feel kind of this sense that of your place. You're also going to be by these columns that are actually supporting the temple. You take those. There's another story in the Bible where Samson is in a temple of a pagan deity, and he stands by these columns and he pushes them down. It actually causes the entire structure to come falling down, and everybody inside dies. So, again, not the same structure, but the same kind of idea. If you've got these two columns, if these columns aren't there, the structure collapses. And so when it was built, the builder's name is Huram, and the Bible says that he named the pillars. Now, Huram was working for King Solomon.
So Huram named them.
That's
what it says.
Seems what, like that's okay. What the Bible indicates. I believe, though, that Solomon told Hiram, you know, this is what I would like you to name them. Okay. And he names them Jachin and Boaz. And that's the part that we kind of come to later on in the sermon. I kind of veer off of the two kings, come back to the names of these columns later on. And what's fascinating about that is that Jachin means to establish, and Boaz can mean different things, but one of the meanings is in strength.
I looked that up.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really cool, that because you had the others, Swift of something.
Fleetness
yeah. of Swift, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool to find the other one.
Yeah. And so I believe that when Solomon does this, he's naming one of these columns after his great, I can never remember, it's two greats or three greats. Two greats, his great-great-grandfather, Boaz. Someone, for those of you listening to podcast, I don't get into this in the sermon. Somebody asked me, though, Melanie asked me, so who's Jachin then?
That was my next question.
And the answer is there is a Jachin in the Bible, but he appears to be sometime in the time of Joshua, maybe.
So that would be after.
Before.
Okay.
And Jachin was a priest. We don't know really anything about him except that the Bible tells us where he was in the rotation of priests that served in the temple. So there was a rotation that they went through. And the Bible says like he was the 12th in rotation or the 20th in rotation. I can't remember what the exact number is. And that's all we know about any Jachins in the Bible.
Hmm.
And so is there more of a story there? We don't know. But with Boaz, I do believe there is more of a story there. And I believe that Solomon gives a little nod to his great-great-grandfather.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that if Solomon told them how to do the temple down to the color of the thread, that he would leave the naming of the pillars to someone else.
Yeah. Or that he didn't know who Jachin was.
Right.
Probably.
And the cool thing about Boaz that we kind of discover in chapter 2, because this is where Boaz first appears in this story of Ruth, and Boaz is a supporting character in this book. But the cool thing about him is that he is very much of a strong person. There are theologians who postulate that he was maybe a warrior, that at some point in his life he had been a warrior and that he was well known for his strength. He was very had a high profile in his community. He was considered to be a very good person. People thought highly of him. And so in chapter 2, when we find him, we find a man that's full of strength. He has a lot of strength financially. He may have a lot of physical strength. He certainly has a lot of strength and influence in his community. And the beautiful thing about this chapter is that we see that he uses that strength to do the things that God had actually asked people to do in the Bible, to take care of the poor, to take care of the widow, to take care of the foreigner that is in their land. And so I think that when Solomon names this pillar that's, you know, in strength, will establish in strength, he has these two things, is that he's really making a nod to the purpose of strength, the strength of those pillars is holding up. It's establishing a house of prayer. In Isaiah, I think I'm getting my verses right. Isaiah says that my house will be a house of prayer for all nations. And it specifically mentions the foreigner, that the foreigner will consider this to be a place. And then in the New Testament, when we find Jesus in the temple, he alludes to Isaiah and says, my house will be called a house of prayer, when he's cleaning out, when he's upset because there are people keeping people out of his house. And again, another point that I didn't really talk about in the sermon, but that's kind of a important thing or helpful thing to understand, is that when Jesus cleanses the temple, the area that was set up, that he's cleansing, that he's getting rid of the people trading money and animals and whatever. This is the only area that Gentiles were actually allowed to be inside in the temple. This is not Solomon's temple. This is going to be Herod's temple by this point that Herod has built. But the premise is still the same. This is the only area in which a foreigner was allowed to be. And so when Jesus says, you've turned my father's house into a den of thieves instead of being a house of prayer, and he alludes back, this passage is going back to Isaiah, he's alluding to that, where Isaiah says, my house will be a prayer house of prayer for all nations. And Jesus is basically saying, look, you've taken the one place that you were allowing foreigners to show up, and you've made it impossible for them to actually worship in this area. Mm. And my goal was always for this place to be a house of prayer for everyone.
For everyone, yeah.
And so when you look at these two pillars back in Solomon's temple, what are they establishing? They're holding up a house of prayer for all nations, a place that was supposed to be not just for the Jewish people, but for everybody who is seeking something more, something better. And that's the case with Ruth. Ruth is here seeking something better for her mother-in-law, for herself. She's joining herself to her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law's religion. And Boaz helps her through his strength to establish that. And one of the fascinating things that we'll talk about a little bit more next week is when you look at the genealogy of Jesus, Boaz is actually listed in it. And Boaz is one of the people who actually not only has a father mentioned, but also has a mother mentioned. Boaz's father is mentioned, and then his mother is mentioned as being Rahab. Now, I think, again, full disclosure, in theological circles, there's arguments about whether this is the same Rahab that we find when the children of Israel come into the Promised Land and go to Jericho, the spies go to Jericho. And there is a Rahab who is a sex worker who hides the spies, and there is debate within the theological community whether this is the same Rahab is Boaz's Rahab. Mother. Is this the same one?
But
I really believe it is, and I know that there's definitely strong arguments why it might not be. But I find it really fascinating that why in the genealogy of Jesus would they name Rahab if we don't know who that Rahab is? Generally, when they mention a female in the genealogy, there's a story behind it that we've heard earlier in the Old Testament.
But wouldn't that be even like you get separate names for people in the Bible so that they're not confused? Like, this is Mary Magdala, this is Mary the mother of Jesus. I mean, in Rahab, that's the only two times her name's mentioned, right? Or Rahab is mentioned in the Bible? Is there more?
Isn't she in the Faith Hall of Fame?
In Hebrews, yeah. She's mentioned in Hebrews, but that would probably come after Matthew's mentioning of her, right? Or at least in the
maybe.
Same time period?
It depends on when you think Matthew was written.
Okay.
So, but that just seems odd that they're without giving some kind of notice.
Right. And so that's one of the things I'll be talking about in this upcoming sermon, too, is that it becomes a really fascinating thing that if Rahab is the Rahab of Jericho, that would have meant that she's a Canaanite. That would mean that Boaz is 50% Israelite, 50% Canaanite, and it means that when he had a child with Ruth, that child would have actually been only one quarter Israelite.
And that it would have been
genetically.
So that would have been David's father.
No, that would have been David's
grandfather. Sorry. And then David, and then, sorry. Well, that seems really, I mean, those are, again, like questions we probably will never know, like 100% for sure. But, man, that makes a great story if it's the same right now.
Well, doesn't that add more to the fact that Christ, through his genealogy, actually is more representative of the entire world than we tend to sometimes make him. That it isn't just exclusively
Jesus was a Jew,
Israelite.
Okay, great.
But that there's actually he has a pretty and then if it And again, what's fascinating to me is that Matthew, when Matthew is naming these women in his genealogy, the other another woman that he mentions is Tamar,
right?
Also a Canaanite, also a really weird story in it. It's like when your dad's your grandpa. That's the story of with Tamar. But again, Matthew seems to go out of his way to name women who are not just Israelite, but are actually foreigners that are outside what would have generally been considered a pure bloodline, Israelite bloodline. And that's Jesus' genealogy. And just anyway, for me, it's just fascinating.
That seems like maybe some extra care would have been given to that Jesus' genealogy if it was important enough to draw any kind of.
But that's exactly it. I think there was extra care given to it.
And yeah, I think
I think that is exactly the point that God would have us make out of Jesus' genealogy, that Jesus isn't, you know, that Jesus is representative of everybody, even the people that have been called outsiders.
I love how you described Boaz just a little bit ago. And I always thought that was one of the cool parts. I mean, obviously Ruth and Naomi are the central part of the story.
Characters.
But when you talk about Boaz, and it almost seems like he's Job without all the mess, without all the destruction and the devastation. Like, he does things the right way. He seems to be, like you said, well respected in his community. And you get that feeling just by reading the story without there being everything having to been called out specifically. And just to think about the way that he kind of moves through this story, and it's just, he's just a unique character. Like there's nobody else like Boaz in the Bible. It doesn't seem like there were one I could think of. And that's always been a cool part to the story to me, was like, hey, this guy does things the right way, from all that we know. And nothing bad happens to him. He didn't like, hey, I was trying to help out, and boom, you touched the ark, or, you know, something, you know, hey, I was just minding my own business and you wiped out my family and my crops and my herds. And, you know, like, I don't know, this, like, sometimes if you just want to find, like, hey, sometimes the good guy wins in the end sometimes. You know, it's like, hey, you know, Boaz is a nice example. Just go read the story of Ruth, and seems like he does a pretty good job. Good negotiator, fair negotiator, follows all the rules, and he still wins.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. I just, that one's been, I've always thought that was maybe one of the coolest parts of the story, but I know that's not the point of the story. So anyway, well, point for me anyway. Why does God leave the margins did they have their own thing? Like, look, do you see my field out there, Ken? My margins are looking pretty fat. What'd you do this year? Well, my margins were down to 1.5 feet. I got to have all I can get this year. Do you think that was a thing? Why did God leave it to people who maybe weren't the best? We've proven over and over again we're not the best to take instruction and do the best things with it. I just thought, like, is this just God trusting them to, hey, I'm just giving you the outline, you guys fill in the blanks?
I just think, I just love that particular aspect of the Bible where God has the Israelites leave margins in their fields, that he has, and that the same thing is true when they're actually, I didn't point this out because it wasn't particularly relevant to this particular story, but it's the same thing with the fruit trees. They were only allowed to go over them once. And so if you miss something.
Olives too, right? Grapes?
Yeah, the same thing. Yeah. You got one go at it, and then if there was stuff that wasn't ripe, then it would ripen up, and the poor and the orphan and the widow could come through and glean. And it's, like I said, there's in the sermon, there's so much dignity in that for everybody. There's the person who is given the opportunity to give to those in the community who don't have, and the people in the community who don't have the opportunity to come out and feel like they earned it and feel like they actually worked for it, and that that it isn't, you know, beneath, you know, it's not just a handout or something like that. And the other part that I think is really worth thinking about is God requires them to leave a margin, and he requires them to give 10%. To give a tithe as well, so they're required to take care of the poor and to leave a 10% as well for God. So there's a lot of giving that God asked for his people to do. A lot of hey, take care of my spiritual work, take care of the people in the community who can't take care of themselves financially, who are in a tough spot financially. And I just think it's this beautiful thing. And it is. It's a nice idea. I mean, maybe, yeah, you can say, hey, I can afford to leave more margin this year because I'm doing so well. And maybe in other years they did leave less margin. But God doesn't give any command on how much of a margin to leave. He just says leave a margin. And then also don't pick up the stuff that you drop when you're harvesting the crop.
Well, the thing that I liked that I feel like often gets missed when we're talking about foreigners and immigration and what you said, that like this makes sure that everyone, you know, everyone's got their hand in it, doesn't leave anybody out. And it also, without God having to tell them, it really keeps the foreigners from being taken advantage of. Like, instead of them saying, well, hey, I could pay you half of what I pay somebody else and you can come in my field and work.
Yeah.
It doesn't enslave that person to make an end meet for a meal, or, you know, I don't know if they sold the other, if they had enough to eat or how that, you know, what the commerce was on that. But without having to just lay it all out, like to me, that was like maybe the coolest byproduct was you're actually protecting the foreign person from being like enslaved for just needing to eat in that process. So that was pretty cool. I always thought that God absolutely invited or directed Ruth to that field.
Yeah.
Like, just assumed, like, well, I mean, if you're going to do this story, right, we have to, I mean, pre-described. I mean, I hate to say that. We have free will and everything. But, like, you know, if I'm going to look at two fields, that looks like the better field over here. And I also thought that I think Boaz, I think his crops were better than anybody else's. He just seemed like someone who had it all together, like maybe was a little more attentive. Is there an alarm going off? Anybody else hear that?
Beeping noise.
Oh, it's probably the trash. He's probably sitting there with it in reverse. Okay, well, hopefully they can't. Well, if you can hear the garbage truck in the podcast, we're sorry. We don't schedule deliveries. Or wait, no.
Pickups.
Please don't deliver. Oh my gosh. Lucas and I opened Amazon boxes. I had my head on deliveries, so there you go. But I just always thought that was a preset conclusion. Like this had to happen this way. Like Jesus being born in the manger, like that had to happen that way. And that was also the way the story unfolds. That is so cool.
Yeah, I would have when I hadn't read the Ruth in a while before I was prepping for this series, and I was under the impression that Ruth had actually been directed to Boaz's field by Naomi because she knew that he was a close. I kind of had that opinion. Then you read through chapter 2, and that is absolutely not the case. I mean, Naomi just basically says to Ruth, "Yeah, if you want to go glean, absolutely go do it." And then the Bible is very clear that she happens upon Boaz's field, and it does feel a lot like God led her there.
That does sound familiar. Is that a narrative that Naomi told Ruth? That when you said it, I was like, oh man, I was wrong. I thought that was the way it was because the other, but it really, no, that's Ruth, not what it says.
Nope. Naomi does not tell her where to go.
Okay.
Well, not at least go. Not according to the second chapter of Ruth.
We'll have to check back in My Bible Friends and see if we were led astray.
I know, right?
It might not be the first time.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's for sure. No, maybe that's it. I've read that story more times than I can care to remember. How many people know a Jakin?
I don't know any Jakins.
No?
I don't know any Jakins.
I know a Jakin.
Do you?
I do.
Really?
Is that your middle name?
No.
Randy Jakin McGray?
Randman Jakin.
Randman Jakin. No. No, I met Jakin at JCI4 in Miami. Oh, geez, that's probably 10, 12 years ago. One of the coolest people I know. So I think the name was given accordingly. So
let's make the name Jakin start popping up the list of baby names. Yeah.
We'll know if the next we've few baby enough, dedications.
I was going to say, we've had so many baby dedications here. For those of you in our church family, we're just saying Jakin.
Jakin.
Think Jakin.
Name.
Establish.
It's a cool name, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it. So, man, that is, I was just curious because when I read the story, it's been a while since I'd read the story, and I was like, the name Jake, and I was like, man, I got to see if my number with him is still good and call him up. So, Jake, if you're listening, I'm about to call, so be ready. You finished up with, what is your strength? How are you using your strength to take care of the orphan, the widow, or the foreigner? Did anyone else just stop and think, like, okay, if this is a challenge, the orphan, the widow, and the foreigner? I mean, I hired Lucas.
Thank you.
The foreigner.
Wow.
I appreciate that.
We'd also like to note for anybody listening that Lucas is cleared by the U.S. government to be working here. Just so that we
I got the green light.
No, but like when you think about it, it's hard because it doesn't seem like in Orlando, most people look at opportunities that might present themselves. And what's the first thing that you think of? Right, it's probably someone on a street corner or in the holding a little sign, whether they're homeless or they're about to be homeless or, you know, there. And I mean, each one could be the widow. It could be the foreigner. But in society, I mean, how is today's society different than when we're talking about with Ruth and Naomi and Boaz versus today? I mean, were there... Do you think there were more opportunities where it's like, oh, this is like everyone knew who the widows were because it was a smaller community and there was more pressure to do that?
Well, let's talk about what's not different. What's not different is that if you're not from around here, you're suspicious. If you're not from around here, you're not part of us. You're not, you know, if your accent is different, then who, you know, do I have a responsibility to you? You're not from around here. And I think that translates across the millennia is that the person who isn't from here is always viewed with suspicion or often viewed with suspicion, and is often felt that there's no obligation from society. And what tends to happen is throughout the millennia is that we tend to dehumanize the people that aren't like us or aren't from where we are. We the people that are in our tribe, that are a part of our clan, those are people. And people outside of it, well, they're people, but they're not the same as us. They're not equal to us. They're different than us. And the challenge that the Bible presents to us, I believe, particularly in this story, is to see every human being as somebody that God created that's just as important as I am to God, that in God's sight is equally valuable, has purpose, has meaning. And when they show up in my life, that I am to treat them with dignity and respect. And that's really the message of that we see threaded throughout the entire Bible. And we see it certainly in this story is that God provides for the person who is different, who may have disadvantaged, and gives them opportunities, and certainly makes sure that they're taken care of and fed. And so I think that probably that our society is very different from the society that Ruth and Boaz and Naomi lived in. There's culturally a lot of differences,
sure.
Huge differences, but in human speak, we often struggle with that person that isn't like me, that's different than me, and it's very easy for us to treat them as less than. And so, I think the challenge for us today, as we talk about immigrants, as we talk about foreigners, as we talk about people who aren't from around here, is to see them as human beings that are deserving of God's love, that are deserving of respect, that are deserving of, of love and kindness. And so we can have all kinds of debates on, you know, politically on how people come into the country and that's fine. Have that debate. But in the process, don't treat people who aren't from here the way that any way different than you would want to be treated if you were in a country that wasn't your own, where you came. And I think probably one of the more troubling aspects for me right now is that there is a lot of dehumanizing of immigrants in this country right now that's going on in our through the media, politically, that we're taking people and you're hearing things like, oh, they're criminals and they're this, that, and other. The statistics simply don't live up to that. All you have to do, and I just invite you to go do it, go to the just type into Google, do a search, and you can go to the FBI's website, mm-hmm. you can go to immigration's website and see the amount of crimes that are committed by immigrant communities, by people in this country. It's lower than the general population. That's the fact. And so are there people that come into our country that have done and are potentially doing heinous things? Yes, there are. But percentage-wise, you're actually safer to be in a room with 100 immigrants than you are 100 U.S. citizens statistically. That's the fact. And so when you start throwing labels on groups that's not even correct, you're doing a disservice. If you want, and somebody will say, oh, well, if you came into the country, you're without following a process, you broke laws. Yeah, absolutely. And fine.
Yeah.
But that's not what I'm talking about. There are so many people in this country that actually have followed process that are actually having problems right now too. I think that sometimes we forget that some of the places that people come from, and as a reporter, I had the privilege of reporting on the last Burmese Myanmar refugee on the island of Guam. And back in the early 2000s, there was a lot of persecution happening in Myanmar. And somehow hundreds of refugees wound up on the island of Guam, and the courts had to decide whether they were going to be allowed into the United States or sent back. And most of the cases got adjudicated, and I got a phone call one day from a wonderful Christian group, not a Seventh-day Adventist group, but a wonderful Christian group that was representing these people who had suffered so much. And they said, we have one last case, and the government's not. It is trying to deny him entry into the United States. A judge, and I think it was the Fifth Circuit, or I can't remember which circuit it was, but a judge had actually taken the government to task for not letting this gentleman come into the country. But they said, "Would you like to interview him?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'd love to." Well, I show up and I discover this guy is a Seventh-day Adventist. I did not know this going in. He's a Seventh-day Adventist, and he shares his story. And he literally watched. He was a lay pastor, and he was doing evangelism in Myanmar. And the people in the village came and said, "You better get lost because the government's going to come and going to kill you." Well, the government caught his partner and killed his partner. And this guy managed to get out of the country and eventually make his way to Guam. And the government's talking about sending him back to Myanmar, which is certain death for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the judge in this particular case, it was one of I got to listen to the audio of the judge, and the judge is like, "Are you kidding?" Because the government was like, "Well, we don't know what will happen to him." He's just like, "Are you kidding?"
Really?
Yeah, really? I think we're pretty clear on what's going to happen to him if he goes back.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of the things that we sometimes forget when it comes to immigrants. And again, I'm all for people going through the right processes and all those sort of things. But one of the things I think we tend to forget is that generally you don't leave your country when things are really going great for you. You know, if life is one, there's usually a reason. People are trying to find a better life, much like most of our ancestors did when they immigrated here to the United States. Almost all of us here in the United States are immigrants, or the children or grandchildren or great-great-great-great-grandchildren of immigrants that came here looking for something better. And so I have a hard time. Like I said, I'm a big fan of people following the law. I'm a big fan of people coming into the country legally. And man, my heart hurts for the people that are really suffering, just looking for a better life for them, for their family, that are trying to contribute, that aren't trying to hurt anything. And again, I'm all for us making sure that we do things properly, but let's not dehumanize people. Let's not throw right. labels on a large group of people that aren't appropriate for that large group of people. And the thing that just keeps getting thrown away around is, oh, these, you know, these people.
Yeah, you're those in trouble people. Already there. Yeah.
That's not the language that Christians should use, and it's just not right. It's, look, let's talk about, you know, there's the politics side of it, but then there's the humanity side of it, the Christian side of it, the side that where God would say, hey, what are you doing to take care of the least of these, the people that are suffering, that are hurting, that are trying to find a better life for themselves? What are you doing to care about them and to look out for them? And I think that's just really important, and it really concerns me. I'm seeing people make comments, well, you know, due process is only for U.S. citizens. Well, that's not what the Constitution says. Go read the Constitution.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Time and again, the Supreme Court has said that due process is for everybody in this country. And the problem is if you don't give due process to everybody, how do you know who's a citizen? Because what that means is if you never take the time to investigate,
right? Yeah.
Then you don't know. And so this is why it becomes important. And again, like I said, I know that some people may view this as a conversation about politics. I hope you don't. I hope you look at it as a conversation about doing right by everybody. Yeah. And taking Christian principles and caring about it. You know, it's funny. One of my children told me that they're like, I think everybody thinks you're a flaming liberal. And I laugh because that has not been the case over the course of my life. But what I do feel passionate about as a pastor, as a Christian, is caring for and loving others and to making sure that I love my neighbor as myself. And Jesus, again, makes it very plain through the story of the Good Samaritan who my neighbor is. It's the person who doesn't look like me and the person who looks like me. It's the person who doesn't speak the same language as me and the person who speaks the same language as me. These are my neighbors, and I owe them in Christ love and care, and to say that they matter.
Well,
and the story of Boaz and Ruth really gets to that.
Even if, like what you talked about, all the different ways that someone can get here, whether it was through breaking the law, not breaking the law, people with circumstances like in your story that you can't possibly know unless you adjudicate and make sure everything is what it's supposed to be. Even if it's, you know, whatever the case is, leave the rhetoric out and just be like, okay, who's here? Who are the people that need to have their process, you know, be able to have their day in court, so to speak. But even if it's the people that you would think maybe are the worst of the worst, as Christians, we're still called to, in that process, it should be, you know, they should be, we're the wealthiest country in the world. There's no reason why, even if we disagree that these people, when they get here, I just said these people, that wasn't right. But when people come for whatever reason, that they all have a chance to be treated like, wow, the USA is really the place I do want to be. I mean, I was treated pretty good there compared to some of the places I had to cross for fear of my life to get there or other places. And even if it means that for whatever reason, the law, whatever, you have to go back to someplace or wherever until maybe you can take another channel, whatever. But that should be like the best process possible for that, where you still feel like, wow, okay, maybe I did it the wrong way, but they actually took care of me. They made sure I was fed. My family stayed together. You know, all those things that we hear about that are wrong in our system. And there's no doubt it's a broken process. And I just think that if we can at least at a bare minimum be that love and say we got to do better in that and make sure that everyone is treated the best they possibly can and with respect. It's like, come on, we can at least, I think we should all be at least able to agree on that. Hopefully. All right. Let's see. Should we do this one first? Let's do this one first since we're talking about it, and then we'll see what Lucas came up with. This was a text, and it was from someone anonymous. I don't know who it is. They said, just want to say thank you for speaking the truth on behalf of foreigners. In light of today's political climate, it took courage to speak out. Helping the least of these is not only biblical, but our duty as followers of Christ. How can we partner with our church family to be the boots on the ground Christians? What's our call to action at Whole Life to make somehow a piece of this, a part of this, something better?
Well, here's what I'd say. The question, I just put the question back in your court. What do you want to do? And how can we at Whole Life support you doing it? There's a lot of different ministries that are run out of this church that happen because we have church members that are passionate about it and share that passion with other people in the church. And our job here as pastoral team is not to run every ministry, but simply to facilitate and help you when you hear God's voice in your life. And when we do that, we can actually accomplish a lot more. We've got, you know, a team of 13 people here at the church, and 13 people can do a lot, but we also have 1,200 church members, and 1,200 church members can do even more.
Yeah.
And so if God's put a passion in your heart for this ministry, I know that we have a number of different church members who help out in this arena in a lot of different ways. I know one church member that goes and works at a center that helps people who are trying to immigrate learn English and learn some basic things, that they go help there. I know that we have a variety. We just recently actually had an immigration attorney come to the church and talk to our church members about what they need to know about immigration and that sort of thing here. And so there's a number of different things that we can do. My question for you is, what is God calling you to do? And for different people, it's different things. I don't think that everybody's called to the same thing. I've had church members that were just absolutely passionate about prison ministries. They wanted to go visit people in prison. It was a big deal to them, and that's where their aspect of what they wanted to do. Yeah. I've had other church members that were just absolutely passionate about helping people who are unsheltered and finding ways to help people transition from living out of a car or on the street to into a home. We've had other church members who are passionate about financial literacy and helping people understand how to make their money work and how to budget correctly. We have people who have been passionate about clean water. We've had people who are passionate about foreign missions, going to other countries and helping those in need in those countries. So the question I have for you is, what has God put on your heart, and how are you going to go about fulfilling what God has put there? And how are you? And we're here to help you find like-minded people. If you have this passion, we'll be happy to go ahead and help you look and see out of the 1,200 other people here at Whole Life who shares that with you. And chances are very good that there's at least a dozen other people that have that same passion and feel that in their heart, and we can help you resource that. We can help you figure out how to work together. We can, if you need some leadership.
Small community.
Yeah, small community. We can help with that, and that is absolutely what we're here to do.
Excellent. All right, Lucas, questions?
Yeah, I got two anonymous questions here. So the first one is, you spoke about that our religion should shape our politics and not the other way around. History shows that when religion and politics mix too closely, it often leads to harm. How can we avoid using religion as a tool of control and more a tool of influence, and following Jesus' example of challenging power with compassion?
Great question. We have seen religion. We have seen people's religion influence their politics in incredibly negative ways. So I don't want to at all deny that. That's absolutely true. And I think that the key was kind of found in that question, which is the words coercion and manipulation. When your religion is trying to force other people to do things they don't want to do, you should think really hard about whether that is good religion or not. It's interesting that God sends the rain on the just and the unjust. It is interesting to me that we serve a God who does not force people to be good. There's certainly encouragement, but we live in a world where it's pretty plain that there are definitely good people and bad people, and God gives us freedom of choice and free will. And I think that our religion, having that viewpoint, having that idea of who God is. And I think that, by the way, there are those who theologically don't believe God gives free will. They think that God creates some people to be evil, and that's just the way it is. And that will impact how you believe things should be going about, too. I don't view that. I believe that God has given free will, and if God gives free will, then I have to do as well. And so I like to think that my life, the way I do things, is the greatest testimony to why what I think is right should be followed. And so whenever we start forcing other people, whenever we start punishing and hurting people who aren't hurting others because they're not following my religious tact and what I believe, we've got some problems. We got huge problems. And so is the basic foundation of God's government love, as described in 1 Corinthians 13, doesn't force its own way, is kind, is patient, is that the kind of, is that what's influencing your political views, or is it this idea that you're going to force everybody else, whether they like it or not, to follow God in the way that you want them to? And if that's the way it is, that's a problematic world, because there's historically, there you never have a majority that agrees religiously on anything. It's always going to be a minority, even within Christians.
Sure.
You have Baptists, you have Episcopalians, you have Presbyterians, you have all these different sects of Christianity that view what God wants in different ways. So that's never going to reach a majority. And that what that means is that if you start going with one group's way of doing it, it means a small minority of people are going to be forcing their religious views on the vast majority, and that is problematic.
So the last one is, you mentioned that we are responsible to use restraint for others. How can someone identify what strength they have to offer?
Great question. I'm trying to think. I want to give you a really good answer. How can you identify your strengths? Well, there are all kinds of different tools out there that you could Google, how can I identify my strengths? And I'm sure it would pop up a couple different things. But then maybe some of the questions are, what do you enjoy doing? What do other people tell you you're good at? What do you get noticed for? Those would be ways of looking at what your strengths are and playing to those. What do you get noticed for? Are you a good writer? Are you really good at physical labor? What is it that you really enjoy that you're good at? And take a look at those things. And
what do your best friends tell you?
Yeah.
Like, oh, at your house, man, we should go to your house because you cook. When you cook, we all eat and enjoy, like, hospitality, maybe that, or cooking, or, you know, things that they tell you. That's a lot of times. Melanie's dad a couple of weeks ago was like, I don't know what we would do in the podcast without you. It's just your thing. He says something to that effect. And I'm like, well, thank you. I like to think it is. And I feel confident in what I do, but it's good. But something like that, if someone says to you, oh man, that's really, you really do this well. Or, you know, like Melanie, you're really good with details. So in the minutia, the things that other people don't think of, and no, but it's true. But those are things that work, that do that. Or Ken, who is really good about giving compliments, like, oh man, that was really great. I saw this. And so, you know, maybe that's just your, whatever your little piece is, those are a good place to start for finding out where your strengths are. And then come and ask me. I'll I'll ask 5 really in-depth questions and give you an answer. I probably will be wrong though, so maybe you should ask your friends, and maybe one of the pastoral staff have a sit down or something and see what you can find out, because I don't know what my 5 questions are even yet, so don't count on that. Okay, next week we're going to take a journey to a random Bible story part 2 with a quick stop by Numbers for some baguettes, or no.
Ooh, that sounds fun. Let's do that.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Okay. Cool. So no Ruth next
Actually,
week.
Actually, we won't do that. That's week four.
That's week four.
No, seriously, we'll talk about genealogy in week four because the final chapter of Ruth actually concludes with the genealogy.
Nice. I feel like Ken and I are starting to get on the same page with these messages now. I finally kind of just through I don't know some kind of power. I'm
There's
starting
a
to.
Vibe.
I'm starting to figure. Vibe. I'm starting to figure it out. It's only been a couple years, so
it's your strength.
Awesome. Well, don't miss Ruth. This has been a really interesting and really fun and really thought-provoking trip through just a four, who knew, four chapters could have all this for us. So definitely tune in next week. Is anything else I'm forgetting? I feel like I'm forgetting something, but I can't think of what it would be. Guys, thanks for listening, sharing, and have a great week.